John 14:8, Philip says, "Show us the Father, and that will be enough for us." It's really interesting. "Show us the Father, and that will be enough for us." Now, this is right after Jesus says a verse that maybe all of us have memorized. "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but through me." And I don't know if any of you memorized this in the same context that I did, but I memorized it learning how to share the gospel. And this is how I understood that verse. I'm the way, the truth, and the life. No one gets to heaven except through me. I'm the way, the truth, and the life. No one gets their sins forgiven unless they put their faith in me. I'm the way and the truth and the life. There's no other Savior but myself. But actually what Jesus is saying is no one gets to the Father. And he saves us not just so that our sins are forgiven, but so that we can have a relationship with the Father. We go to heaven, but heaven's a great place because the Father's there. And I think for a lot of my life, I thought Jesus wanted to lead me to salvation, but he actually wants to lead me to the Father. That's the way. The way leads to the Father. Now, right after that, Philip said, right after that, he said, "Show us the Father." So he actually heard Jesus say this, but he didn't understand it. And I wonder how many of us hear Jesus say it, but still not understand what that means or feel like that we've actually experienced it. He says, "Show us the Father, and that will be enough for us." One of the things about God as Father that's complicated is that we have the Holy Spirit, we have Jesus, we have the Father. We don't have another Holy Spirit, so he exists in his own category. We don't have another Jesus, so he kind of sits by himself. But the minute you say Father, I think of my Father, my earthly Father. And the way that what we've experienced from our earthly fathers actually deeply impacts how we experience God as Father. It's one of the reasons why people don't get to the Father is because they have another Father that gets in the way. We often see God, our Father, our Heavenly Father, through the filter of our earthly fathers. And our earthly fathers deeply impact us because fathers make a big difference. They're really important. You know, why are they so important? Well, here's a picture of myself as a very small child. My dad and my parents were missionaries in the Philippines. That's where I was born. So there's me in the Philippines with my missionary father. Well, my dad is a very important person in my life. Just one of my heroes, one of my best friends. Here is a picture of the two of us when he was 94 years old, almost 95. He's still holding up pretty well. Looks a little different, but he was in the Navy, so he has a Navy cap on, and I got to visit him where he lives in Denver. And it was such a precious time. Anytime I get with my dad just means so much to me. We went out and he showed me his latest garden, you know, so we experienced that together, and his latest wood pile. So he grew up on a farm, so those kinds of things are important. And so, you know, we just kind of got to spend that bonding time together. Well, about a year after that, he went to be with Jesus. He passed 95, but he's with his Father right now. And I miss him. Now, I've had him a lot of my life, but there's a hole there. My dad is really important to me. That father space is really significant. Now, I'm a father too. So this is myself and my family just a little when the kids were a little bit younger. So I have three children. That's when they were all teenagers. And they got married, and then we got another generation coming. So this is from not long ago. I've got six grandkids. Well, you know, your kids grow up, and I'm still a father. And fathering is a challenge, and there's things that they need from me, but will I be successful at giving them? And there may be more that they need that I'm not even capable of. Those father needs really continue all our lives. Fathers are really important people. And as you look at history, you sometimes find very successful, prominent people, and you don't realize what kind of father baggage they carry or what kind of father pain they carry. This is King George VI, and you may have seen a film about him called The King's Speech. I don't know if you remember that film, but basically this young king had a pretty big problem. He couldn't speak without stuttering. Now, that wasn't much of a an issue before the age of radio and communication where kings had to communicate not just in written form, but in verbal form. And so he had to have a special tutor teach him not to stutter. And that's the whole focus of this movie, The King's Speech. But part of what the movie does is explore why he stuttered. Why would a king stutter? Why would a king be so insecure? He's a king that he wouldn't be able to speak straight. Well, he had a dad, King George V, who was... It was a pretty stern man, and their relationship wasn't the greatest. In fact, King George V said this. He said, "My father was frightened of his father. I was frightened of my father. And I'm damn well going to see it that my children are frightened of me." And that's what happened to King George VI. He was so frightened of his father, it didn't matter if he was king of the country. He still was so insecure that he couldn't speak straight. So fathers leave permanent impact and some wounds. You all know who this is, Adele. Adele's worth, they say, about $220 million now because of her album. She's just unbelievably talented, but she has a very painful relationship with her father. Her father abandoned her. Mark Evans is her father, abandoned her when she was just 3 years old. Then when she got famous, he tried to get back involved in her life and also gave some interviews where he shared some things about him, and it just made Adele very mad. She said, "I was actually trying to start having a relationship with him again, but he's blown it. He'll never hear from me again." And this is what she says: "It makes me angry to come back after 10 years and be like, maybe her problem with men comes down to me. How dare you comment on my life? It makes my blood boil. It blows my mind," she said. "I love her so much, really? Why are you telling me that through a newspaper? If I ever see him, I'll spit in his face." Okay, those are pretty strong words from a famous singer about her dad who abandoned her when she was 3 years old. Or this, another famous singer, Janet Jackson. And she talked about her childhood, and she said, "When she was young, I would literally bang my head up against the wall because I didn't feel attractive." Does that make sense with what you see? "I banged my head up against the wall because I didn't feel attractive." And she said, "I grew up with self-esteem issues, never having the father I really wanted, and the pain of losing my brother, Michael." But it's interesting. She said, pain of losing my brother, but never having the father that I really wanted. In this interview that I read, she opened up about her father, Joe, saying she wasn't to ever call him dad. He said, "I'm Joseph to you. You do not call me dad." That affects you as a kid. "I know my father loves me. He just has a very, very different way of showing it." So here's someone who's beautiful, talented, but just carrying around this wound in her heart, deeply affected until today by her relationship with her dad. Or this man, Steve Jobs. Maybe you don't know, but Steve Jobs actually was adopted. He was given up by his biological father and then ran into him again. They actually didn't know it, but his biological dad would go to a coffee shop where he worked at a coffee shop where Steve Jobs would frequent. And then they found out, but they never talked to each other, partially because Steve was mad about being abandoned, and his father was so proud he couldn't cross the boundary. And his father, who was quite a successful businessman himself, said this. He said, "This might sound strange, though, but I am not prepared, even if either of us was on our deathbeds, to pick up the phone to call him." Wow, that is a broken relationship, right? And you can imagine how that affects people when they experience that. You know, there is so much pain related to fathers. That's why movies, it's often a theme, but it will always also be a theme if you're involved in any pastoral work. You'll be talking to people and they'll be talking about something totally different and then reflect back and talk about the pain they experienced with their father. And it'll be like it was today. Well, how does that get healed? And how does that affect the way they see God, who is father? There's an agency in Canada called the Father Involvement Research Alliance, kind of a big name, FIRA. But they do a lot of research about how does father involvement impact young people. And if you get on and take a look at that, they talk about how it impacts brain development, how it impacts relationships. They've studied so many things that just father involvement. Fathers involved will make a difference. They'll say school-age children of involved fathers are better academic achievers. They're more likely to get A's, have better quantitative and verbal skills, and perform a year above their expected age level on an academic test. So if dad's involved, the kids actually perform a year better in school just because dad's engaged in their lives. And then they went on and said, on the other hand, father involvement is positively correlated with a child's overall life satisfaction, their experience of less depression, less emotional distress, less fear and guilt, fewer conduct problems, higher levels of self-reported happiness, and fewer anxiety symptoms. That's so many things that relate back to just fathers being engaged. Here's something else. Adolescents, that was about children, who strongly identified with their fathers were 80% less likely to have been in jail and 75% less likely to become unwed parents. On the other hand, adolescents in father absent homes, boys are more likely to be unhappy, sad, depressed, dependent, and hyperactive. Girls who grew up in father absent homes are more likely to become overly dependent and have internalizing problems such as anxiety and depression. So it has, and this is just fathers are engaged, they're present, they're emotionally engaged with their kids. It doesn't have anything to say about how talented they are. It just means they're engaged. Now, this is also interesting because a study that was done in the United States with the with Promise Keepers and the Baptist denomination found this. If a father does not go to church, even if his wife does, there's only a 2% probability that their children will attend church as adults. But if a father attends regularly, there's a 60 to 75% probability their children will attend church as adults, regardless of what the mother does. That's interesting. In other words, if the father goes to church and mom doesn't, kids will most likely go to church. If mom goes to church and the kids don't, they probably won't. But there's so much power in the leadership of fathers in their homes and the spiritual leadership of them. Here's another one. If a mother is the first person in a household to become a Christian, there's a 17% probability everyone else in the household will follow. However, when the father is first, there's a 93% probability that everyone else in the household will follow. Crazy, isn't it? Now, we love mothers. There's moms here in this room. We're going to talk a little bit about even your role a little bit later on. But there's something particularly powerful about a father role and a father voice and a father presence that we're going to find as time goes on that is not just interchangeable and that people desperately need. When I was working on my book, I came across this book, which is very interesting, called Father Hunger. And it's by a psychologist who specialized in eating disorders, particularly women with eating disorders. And she was trying to stop the cycle self-purging, just all kinds of over problems with eating disorders. But as she went on, she began to start to see a repeating pattern of these young girls who had eating disorders talking about their dads. And she said, she discovered that when dads are uninvolved, absent, or inconsistent, their daughters experience what Barbara was describing, a deep, unrelenting father hunger. And in this book, she says, all children long for a close, loving relationship with their fathers. They're born with an innate drive to connect with them. Children literally yearn for this correct connection. When this normal craving is satisfied, children are likely to grow up feeling confident, secure, strong, and good enough. Often, however, this yearning is not acknowledged, and the need for a bond with a father grows, causing self-doubt, pain, anxiety, and depression. Father hunger is a deep, persistent desire for emotional connection with the father that is experienced by all children. And then she goes on, she says, like physical hunger, unsatisfied emotional hunger does not disappear. Instead, it grows and grows. Adults who have not found a way to relate to their fathers or resolve their feelings of loss may continue to suffer this hunger indefinitely. They bring their longing to new relationships when they become spouses and parents. In this way, father hunger is passed through generations. And actually, I think there's a lot of believers who have father hunger, who are father deficient. Now, we're not going to change our dads. We're not going to be perfect dads. So one of our main question here is, how does our connection with God as Father actually truly meet these needs of our soul, truly satisfy our father hunger, this deep emotional need that every child has or every person has for connection with the Father? It's actually, I think, a bigger need than our earthly fathers can provide. I think the best father is not going to be good enough. So let's turn to the Word now. So I know there's probably a lot going on in your mind as you read some of those things. And here's one of the questions: what actually do you need from a father? So if there's this father hunger, and if father engagement brings so much, what's happening in that particular relationship? And when I begin to study this area, I thought, why not benchmark by the best? The best father-child relationship is the relationship of God with His Son, Jesus. It's totally untainted by sin. It's absolutely perfect. So what would we find if we started looking at that relationship as the standard for our for what we need from our Father? And there's actually three places in Scripture where we overhear the Father talking to the Son. Now we'll get in a little bit to what Jesus says when He reflects on His relationship with the Father. But here we actually get to observe it. And let's start with the first one. The first one is in Matthew 3, verse 17. So Jesus being baptized, and verse 16, as when Jesus was baptized, immediately He went up from the water, and behold, the heavens were opened to Him. And He saw the Spirit of God descending like a dove and coming to rest on Him. And behold, a voice from heaven said, okay, here we get to listen to the Father talk to the Son. This is My beloved Son with whom I am well pleased. Okay, just one sentence. It's My beloved Son with whom I'm well pleased. Coming from heaven before Jesus has done anything. This is at the beginning of His ministry, not at the end. There doesn't seem to be any performance that Jesus has done that has earned this. It's not hidden. It's proclaimed in front of everyone. It's not just thought in the Father's mind, but it's actually expressed very clearly in words. This is really powerful. This statement is so full of meaning. And then if you go on to the next one, it's in Matthew 17, 5. Really different setting. Much later on in Jesus' ministry, He leads several of His disciples up to a mountain, and there He's transfigured before them. And His face shone like the sun, His clothes became as white as light. And behold, there appeared to Him, verse 3, Moses and Elijah talking with Him. And Peter said to Jesus, Lord, it's good that we are here. If You wish, I will make three tents here, one for You and one for Moses and one for Elijah. He's just talking, right? He doesn't really know what's going on. And He was still speaking when, behold, a bright cloud overshadowed them. And a voice from the cloud said, listen up. So second time we overhear it. This is My beloved Son with whom I'm well pleased. Listen to Him. Now, do you notice anything? It's the same, right? Now, isn't this interesting that if you overheard a father and son talking to each other only twice, and there was only one sentence shared, and it was exactly the same sentence, wouldn't you say that sentence has a lot of significance? Like, it might capsulize the key thing that's happening in their relationship between them. By the way, the third time is when Jesus says, glorify Yourself. And a voice comes to heaven and says, I have glorified Myself and I will glorify Myself. So that's the third one. So it's a little bit different. But these two times it says exactly the same thing. I believe this has tremendous significance. We're going to find out a little bit more later on. Because I believe that this outlines, this summarizes four streams of God's Father heart. Four things that are happening from the Father to His Son, from the Father to us, that are streams of resources, streams of emotional, spiritual, personal resources that are coming. And here they are. This is My Son. This is my son. A declaration of identity. This is who you are. This is my son, whom I love. The second stream of love. With him I am well pleased. Pleasure, delight, satisfaction. And then there's one more. It's not in the first one, but it's in the second one. He says, listen to him. So what is he saying there? What's going on right there? Well, remember, right before that, Peter said, it's all good that we're here. We're going to make three tents, one for you, one for Elijah, Moses, Elijah, and then Jesus, this is your tent. And the Father says, no, you listen to my son. And I really believe that this is about place. See, Peter was saying, Jesus, you belong in this tent, right beside the other two tents. And God the Father was saying, no, I'm going to define my son's place. And I'm going to defend it. You're supposed to be listening to him and not him listening to you. And we'll see this more just a little bit later on. But I really believe this fourth stream is a stream of place. It's a stream of place. So look at that. It's actually similar to our physical hearts. They have four chambers, right? It's also similar in that these four things are places where we need to receive and give. And just like if my physical heart isn't working, I'm going to have problems with all the rest of my body. You don't see my heart, but if my heart stops, my life stops, right? And I get nutrition and oxygen and sustenance coming right to the corners of my body. Everything I do is impacted by the nutrition that's flowing through my heart. And I believe that these four resources that come from God, the Father heart, into our lives and through us to other people are just absolutely, absolutely essential. They meet the most basic needs of your soul. You have needs of your body, things like oxygen and water and food. I believe that these are soul needs. I believe that these are needs that every non-Christian has as well, which is why, by the way, you know, we'll get into this a little bit later on, but so much of life actually centers around these things. Identity. What's my career? What kind of degree do I have? Have I been successful? Who am I? People are going, I'm traveling around the world to find myself. Love. How many songs are about love? How much energy is spent looking for love? Pleasure. Huh. Just think of all the ways we seek pleasure and we seek to please people. Either pleasing ourselves or pleasing others. I need more likes on my Facebook site. I need to be more impressive. I need to dress right so that other people go, you're great. I like you. That was awesome. Cool. That kind of pleasure from them. Or place. Where's my spot? Where do I belong in the world? Do I have a place in this community? Do I have a place in this business? Do I have a place in my church? Do I have a place in my family? Place is so central in people who are placeless. It's a basic need of who we are. If they're not filled, you'll be gasping for them. Just like if I don't have air, I start to try to get it. If I don't have water, I'm going to be looking around for it. If I don't have food, it's going to overcome other things. If you don't have it, you'll be gasping for it. And if you do have it, you'll have stability and resources for every situation. It kind of forms a bedrock of personal stability or soul stability. If you know who you are, if you know you're loved, if you know that you're pleasing the one who matters most, and if you know that you have a place, and a place that's given and received, not just fought for and conquered somehow, that gives tremendous stability in life. What's this look like practically? You actually see then Jesus talking about it himself. Any guess at what chapter has the most references to God as Father? Any just guess? It's in what's that? It's in John. It's exactly in John. Any one that has the most references? Did you say it? 17, you're close. It's in that zone. It's in the Upper Room Discourse as 14. 14 has the most references to God as Father. Do you have any idea which has the second most? It's also in John. And I'm going to tell you, because it'd be really hard to guess this one. It's John 5. So Most references to God as Father, John 14. Second most references to God as Father, John 5. And we'll see why as this passage unfolds. So open this. You'll need to look at it. And what happens in this chapter is Jesus heals a man who is at a pool called Bethesda. And this is amazing because this man has been an invalid for 38 years, and Jesus heals him in one day. So he goes and announces this to everyone. One problem, though, he did it on the wrong day. He did it on the Sabbath. So rather than being excited about this major miracle, the Pharisees are mad at him. And in verse 15, the man went away and told the Jews that it was Jesus who'd healed him. And this is why the Jews were persecuting Jesus, because he was doing these things on the Sabbath. So they're persecuting him. Now we're going to start going into this thing about identity. And you'll see. Now, what would happen if people were persecuting you for healing on the wrong day? Let's say in your town, you know, in Gdansk, in Hranice, in Northern Ireland, somehow you get the gift of healing. And you heal someone who's been invalid for 38 years. And then everyone in your church starts getting critical of you and saying, you shouldn't have done it on Sunday because it's the Lord's day. You know, you shouldn't have done it then. How would you respond? Well, I probably would say, I'd be defensive. I might say, well, what are you doing? You all are just sitting around in pews, and I was out there healing at least, you know? And I might kind of be critical of them. I might be hurt. Oh, I'm so hurt. I'm working so hard to bring healing to people, and they're criticizing me. And look how Jesus responds. My Father is working until now, and I'm working. So it's interesting. He's under pressure, and he steps back into his relationship with the Father to find his stability. My Father's working, and I'm also working. And this is why the Jews were seeking all the more to kill him, because not only was he breaking the Sabbath, he was even calling God his own Father, making himself equal with God. So they understood this. If God's your Father, then you have tremendous value. You see, they say, make himself equal with God. Well, just automatically, if God's your Father, if you're God's son, then And we know it's like that. You have identity from who you're related to. And so they was making himself equal with God. And then he says, truly, I say to you, the Son can do nothing of his own accord, but he only does what he sees the Father doing. For whatever the Father does, the Son does likewise. You see, he's just saying, I know who I am. I'm doing this because my Father does it. And I have a clear identity. So you say I shouldn't heal. My Father heals. I heal. And you just see him stepping back into his identity and finding security there. So one of the things we need to realize is identity gives value. If I know who I am, then all of a sudden I'm if I have the right idea of who I am, my life has value. So here we go. Identity gives value. Now, I remember as a small child, I'd play out on the playground at school, and sometimes you'd get in conversations with other kids and ask the question, what does your dad do? What does your dad do? Someone would say, my dad's a pilot. My dad's a, you know, garbage collector. Well, that's not great. But I would say, my dad is the executive director of Overseas Christian Servicemen Centers. Huh? Pretty good, huh? Huh? That's crazy. I had no idea what that meant. But it sounds really good. Yeah, my dad's the executive director of Overseas Christian Servicemen Center. He led a mission organization. But I can remember as a child that if my dad's somebody, then I'm automatically somebody. Now, I haven't done anything yet, but my dad's important. So, you know, don't you mess with me. And identity words from fathers are also really important. When I'm the second child in our family, I have an older sister who's just... When she was young, well, she still is, but she spoke quick, early, was very sharp, a quick learner, remembered everything, knew everyone's name. And then I came second, and I was really different than that. Just, I couldn't remember names. I talked slow. I forgot things. And I remember my dad telling me once, Dave, it doesn't matter if you're not a smart boy, just as long as you're a good boy, because they actually thought something was wrong with me when I was young. But one of the things that happened was, because my sister was so quick to speak, my only defense was I just had to talk louder than she did. And so I had one volume, it was very loud, and I talked slow, but I would just try to, you know, hold my own with my talented sister. And I remember one time my dad was listening to me trying to talk over my sister, and he said, Dave, you're going to make a great preacher someday. I was like, really? Well, why is that? He says, well, because preachers need to have strong voices, and God gave you one of those. And I was maybe 3.5, 4 years old, but I remember that to this day, because identity words from a father, this is who you are, really sink deep. And I'm preaching today, right? So identity words from a father, they're really powerful, particularly if they're positive. They are really powerful, and we get a lot of identity from what our fathers say, who they are, and what they say about us. So if we get these gifts in this area of if we get gifts from knowing, hey, I belong to him, I'm connected to him, and he's somebody great and dependable and worthy of admiration has some, well, wow, then I'm someone as well. And also father words about who we are. And this is why fathers have to really watch how they talk about their kids. Because my dad could have said, why are you always talking, Dave? You're just so insensitive. You know, you just can't tell how loud you're talking, and that's just so stupid. A lot of fathers do things like that, thinking that by speaking negative identity words, their children are going to be motivated to change. But actually, those negative identity words imprint them with, this is who you are. And there's a lot, by the way, in this area of the world, there's a lot of shame-based motivation in schools and in families. If I'll tell you how bad you are, you'll do something and change. But actually, often those words, those identity words, you are, not just about their behavior, but about their identity, go really deep and really mark us. So if I have these gifts, it actually gives a healthy giving and receiving. So if I've been imprinted with the right identity, well, I'm open, I'm confident, I can give identity to others. I'm more resilient when people say things. I might go after some difficult things because I have a sense of who I am, and that sense, if it's accurate, will really hold me firm and drive me forward. Now, here's a second area. Love. Now, in verse 15, it says, in verse 18, he says, the Father's working now and I'm working. You think, okay, that's going to satisfy them. You know who I am. You know my identity. And no, they want to kill him even more. So now it's just not there. They're not just critical of him for healing on the Sabbath. They actually want to kill him for healing someone who was sick for 38 years. I mean, this is crazy. Now, what would you do if you see you just healed someone and, you know, in Gdansk or in Hranice or in Northern Ireland or Hungary or whatever, and the criticism has reached so high that you found out that there's actually a plot on your life by the elders, okay? They're thinking how they can kill you. How are you going to respond? You know, I might say, time to go to another town, stop this. Or I might say, time to get a gun. You know, time to protect myself, because I've got to be violent in return. But look at what Jesus says. He says, verse 20, for the Father loves the Son and shows him all he's doing. And greater works than these he will show him so that you may marvel. Okay, if someone came up to you and put a gun to your head, would you say, hey, just before you shoot, I just have to tell you one thing. My Father loves me. Isn't that a crazy response? To talk about how much your Father loves you when you're getting threatened with your life? Why would you say, my father, hey, by the way, just so you know, before you shoot, just know my Father loves me. Now, it might make sense, though, if your father is the chief of police and he's standing right outside the door and he's got a bigger gun than the one that I have, right? And that because this is what's interesting. Sometimes we think of love as being It's all romantic and it's pink and soft petals and soft music. But if you love someone, you'll fight for them. If you love someone, you'll defend them. If you love someone, you'll sacrifice. And there's a fierce nature to love. And if the Father loves him, well, then the Father, the commander of the angel armies, is going to protect him. And he says, hey, guys, before you try to kill me, just know my Father loves me. Interesting, right? And here's the thing that love gives, is it gives security. It gives security. If I know I'm loved, I actually know I'm safe. If I know I love, I know I'm safe. And as I've prayed with many people over these years, leading the God's Father heart, there's sometimes where people will have a deep experience of the love of the Father, which I pray you do along the way too. Something that's more than just intellectual, but where you actually are overwhelmed by the powerful Father love of your Heavenly Father. It's just an amazing experience. And often they get really quiet when that happens. And they'll just kind of sit there. And they'll say, what are you feeling right now? And almost always what they'll say is, they'll say, I feel safe. I feel safe. Isn't that interesting that when we know how deeply we're loved, we actually are safe. And there's so many things that are threatening us in the world around us. Economies that are crumbling, wars that are on the other side of the border, insecurity, uncertainty. But if you deeply know you're loved and you know who you're loved by, the God of the universe who, you know, has angel armies and is sovereignly in control and can take out leaders and change things and protect you in the midst of it, well, then all of a sudden, you're safe. You're safe. No matter what happens. Do you love me? Now, that's the key question here. My dad grew up in a divorced home. He worked on a farm. His mom left him with the other two kids when he was 12 years old, and it was just he and his dad. So he grew up in a pretty, not much extra emotional resources environment. And because of that, he didn't really know how to express love. He was good at giving identity and some other things like that, but I don't remember a single time as I was growing up that I ever heard my dad say, I love you. Now, I knew that he did. I could kind of figure that out, but he wasn't good at expressing it. And neither was he good at expressing it physically. He just wasn't a particularly physical person. It was just like, hey, you know that I love you, so, you know, that's the way it is. One time, I went away to Bible college, and I was just thinking about my relationship with my dad, and I went, I just really want to be closer to my dad. And I thought, when I get home, I'm gonna greet him with a hug, which we never did. And I'm actually gonna tell him I love him. So I thought about this a long time. So I get home, been gone for about 6 months, come in the door, and I come to my dad, and I said, Dad, so great to see you. And I gave him a hug. And it was like hugging a board. You know, he was just like that. He didn't know what to do. It's like, this is too close, you know. And so I went like this, and he kind of went, you know, like that a little bit. And then I said, Dad, I've really missed you. I love you. And he didn't know what to do. He went, yeah, me too. He actually didn't know how to put the words. I mean, it was, he had a hard time loving. Now, I deeply respected my dad, and so somewhere along the line figured out that, you know, hey, I don't really need love, right? Yeah, I'm fine without it. Who needs love? And in fact, one time, one of my friends said something. Said, Dave, God really loves you. And I was like, yeah. She said, no, Dave, God really loves you. Oh, okay. And she said, that doesn't touch you, does it? I said, no, it doesn't. Because I kind of got cold to love. And here's what happens when you don't have something, you have a vacuum, right? My dad didn't hate me. He didn't beat me up, but there was just an absence of love in that relationship. And what happens is that produces one of two things. It either produces deadness. Think if you just took all the air out of this room, you know, you just like this. You just kind of get dead to that area. Or else some of you would be fighting and you'd be running for the window and you'd be trying to do something about it. And those are the two responses. When there's a vacuum, people either get kind of numb to that area in their lives. You know, love. I don't need love. No, then you don't need love either. Love. What's love? Or else they're like this. Do you love me? Do you love me? Would you love me? Well, do you love me enough? I need a little bit more love. And they'll just be like, you know, vacuums suck, don't they? They pull. So they either create these pulls where there's, and you can see people like that. And sometimes they alternate. They'll be dead to love and then they'll be trying to grab it. And they'll be dead to it and they'll be trying to grab it. Those are two symptoms that you'll see. Now, I was pretty dead to love. That's how I dealt with it. And then I started dating this really cute, wonderful girl. And we were dating long distance. I was living in Germany. She was living in Portland. And so that was back before FaceTime and all these different things we have. So we sent each other cassette tapes. You remember that? You know, way back, these little cassette tapes. I put in a tape recorder. I talked to her for 45 minutes straight and then put it in a padded envelope and sent it across an ocean. And she'd listen to it and then answer. And, you know, the fastest it would happen would be 2 weeks. So this is a conversation with a two-week delay. Now, the advantage is that no one interrupts you. You know, you talk the whole time. But your questions, it takes a while to get them answered. So that's how we were relating to it, with two-week delays in 45-minute conversations. And one day I got an envelope from her and I opened it up. I thought, I'm gonna listen to it on the way into work. I put it in the car, started listening to it. And she just sounded a little strange. And she said, I got some things to tell you. You know how often women will kind of build up to everything and us men were kind of going, get to the point. And that's what I was feeling like. She's going to tell me something, but I don't know what it is. And then she said, I have this song I want to sing you. She sang me a song. And then at the end of that, she said, Dave, I'm breaking up with you. She said, I really like you, but I do not feel any love from you. I go to the end of your cassette and I listen to the beginning. I'm trying to get any expression of love, but it's just like you're giving me lots of reports and thoughts and I don't feel any love. And she says, I hope sometime you find a woman you can love, but I'm not willing to be in a relationship without that. So, you know, so goodbye, have a good life. And I'm going, wait. You're talking to a cassette tape and you can't get. So I spun around and went back home and waited till it was morning in Portland. And first I called one of my friends who was there. And I said, Dave, good friend. I said, Connie just broke up with me. And he said, yeah. I said, what do you mean, yeah? He said, yeah, I was wondering if she'd go through it. What do you mean? Well, she talked to me about it. What'd you tell her? He said, I told her to do it. She said, you don't know how to love. She deserves something better. I'm like, you used to be my best friend, you know? And then I called up Connie and said, Connie, could you give me another chance? It was just really a wake-up call for me. It was like somebody trying to wake up the dead. Because here's what happened. My heart was cold to my Heavenly Father, but also was unable to communicate love on. And this is what happens when you have deadness. You don't just have deadness in receiving. You also have deadness in giving. Or you don't just have pulls in receiving. You also have pulls in giving. You know, people that love and they really aren't loving. They're really trying to get love. I love you. Do you love me? I care about you. How much do you care about me? And it warps both the giving and receiving. By the way, that I didn't finish that story. Connie did say that she'd give me another chance, and we've been married for 30 some years. What is it? 30? I should know the number. 36, I think, years right now. But I just about lost her as she was walking away, and it was a shock to my system. And I've often told her a really good shock. Because I kind of needed this, you know how you just, those paddles on your heart, like, to wake me up. So, we're done. We're finished with our first, we just divide up into six lessons, and we're going into the second one, which is, we'll continue to unpack the heart. But I want to also just make a little side observation right here that's interesting. God is called Father only 15 times in the entire Old Testament. Only 15 times, but 167 times just in the Gospels. 40 times in the Pauline epistles, 13 times just in the book of 1 John, and then also we talked about John 14. So there's this kind of this explosion of access to God's Father. And that's actually one of the reasons Jesus came, was so that we could have a relationship with God as Father that we wouldn't have apart from Christ. And we're going to talk about that a little bit more tomorrow. But it's important to understand this, just this explosion of the topic of God as Father in the 23 times in John 14. So if 15 times in the whole Old Testament and then 23 just in John 14. And here's some interesting verses just in John 14. We'll come back to John 14 tomorrow. But the Father's house is your destination. Jesus says, I'm leaving and I'm going to, in my Father's house are many rooms. If it were not so, I would have told you, I'm going there to prepare a place for you. So it's our destination. I'm the way, the truth, and the life. And no one comes to the Father but through me. John 14, 7, he says, Philip, have you been with me so long? If you know me, you know the Father. But a lot of people know Jesus and they don't know the Father, like Philip. Jesus is supposed to bring the Father to us, but sometimes we don't know him enough to know the Father. And then 14:8, which we got before, Philip says, show us the Father and we'll be satisfied. And then 14:9, this is in your notes. It's possible to spend a lot of time with Jesus and still not know the Father, because these disciples have been with Jesus for three and a half years, and they're still saying, hey, we don't know the Father yet. You know, I wonder how many people have been in church for years, and they know a lot about the Bible, and they know a lot about Jesus, but they really have not met the Father as their Father. So now, one other observation I want to make, these are really interesting areas. The top of that is more ontological. It's about being, identity and love. Those are being. And the bottom two are more relate to activity, pleasure, and place. Do you delight? And then also, where's my place? So the top is more about being. The bottom is more about doing, which is kind of interesting. And then you also see that that these relate to each other. My identity lives itself out in my place. So let's say my identity is I'm a musician and I am first chair trumpet in the orchestra. That's my place. So identity and place tie together, and love and pleasure are two sides of the same coin. I can love someone and be very disappointed in them and be displeased with them. But they're similar emotions. They go together. Love and pleasure are two sides of the same coin, the being and doing side, just like identity and place are being and doing. So it's just very, very interesting how that picture fits together. So let's go back to John 5 and continue there, because you see Jesus continue. This is so crazy that right here in John 5, he continues to reflect on these same things. He says in John 5, 30, this is about pleasure. 5:30, he says, I can do nothing on my own. As I hear, I judge. My judgment is just. Why? Because I seek not my own will, but the will of him who sent me. So he's saying, I want him to be happy. It's his will. I want him to be pleased. And then a little bit later on, 41 through 44, he says, I do not receive glory from people. Their applause, their pleasure. But I know that you do not have the love of God within you. I've come in my Father's name, and you do not receive me. If anyone comes in his own name, you will receive him. How can you believe when you receive glory? So again, that acclaim from one another, and do not seek glory that comes from the only God. So you see, he's saying, hey, guys, my motivation is to please him, do his will, and get his applause. That glory that comes from him. Your motivation is not. You're not wanting that. Here's the key question. Do you delight in me? Are you pleased with me? Are you proud of me? Do I bring you joy? So my dad was a director of a mission organization. It meant he traveled a lot. Sometimes he would be gone for up to 3 months at a time, because he would start in where we lived in Colorado, and he would go out on a trip and visit all the missionaries in his mission and travel the whole way around the world and come back. So once he was out, sometimes he would stay out for a long time. But he'd often be gone for a month traveling. And I remember when I knew that he was going to return, I thought a lot about it. You know, Dad's coming home. Dad's coming home. What would that be like? And one time when he was gone, it was spring, and the grass was starting to grow in Colorado. The trees were starting to bloom. And I noticed that our yard was not in good shape, that the bushes needed to be trimmed, and that there was nothing growing in the flower beds. And I thought, I'm going to surprise Dad. Now, as a boy, I was about 12 years old, that was the words I used, surprise him. But really, really what I wanted is that I'm going to make him really pleased, you know, which is a real win for a kid. So when I got home from school that day, I spent the whole afternoon working, digging up the flower beds, trimming the bushes. I trimmed along the walkway so that it was straight. I mowed the lawn. And the whole time I'm thinking, oh, Dad's going to be so surprised. Oh, he's just not going to believe this. And then I said, Mom, could you take me to the store so I could buy some flowers? And I bought those and I planted them. The whole time I'm just thinking about my dad's return. Well, a couple days later, he got back. My mom went to the airport and picked him up, brought him home, drove into our driveway. And I went and said, hi, Dad, you know, and remember that was before it was like, hi, Dad. But then I went and grabbed his suitcase and started pulling it around the corner of our garage. But I'm not watching out there. I'm watching him like this. And we rounded the corner and he just stopped. And he said, wow, the yard looks amazing. The bushes are trimmed and the sidewalk is edged. And who planted those flowers in the flower bed? And I kind of went, that was me. And my mom added, and she said, you know, nobody told him to do it. You did it all by yourself. How did you know how to do that? Wow, that must have taken a lot of work. You are so, and my dad started speaking those words of joy and pleasure. You know what that's like, you know? I'm proud of you. That was amazing. And I'm watching him closely. I can see the delight in his face, see the joy. And it was totally worth it. I probably did a week of work. But I was like, I won the award. Look at my dad's face. Look how pleased he is. Well, this is what's interesting. Pleasure gives motivation. And Jesus says, I'm not working to please myself. I'm working to please the Father. He said, your problem is you're working to please someone else. By the way, people who are convinced that they're a failure and convinced that they can't please anyone, they really lose their motivation. You know, why try? Why risk? Why work hard? If I just am going to find someone say, well, it's just not enough. It either can motivate you like it did me those 4 days or 5 days, whatever, how long it took. And this reward of Dad is pleased. I had when I served in Germany on military bases doing youth ministry, and one of our staff members, his name was Greg, and he was such a gifted youth worker. He had a junior high, so a middle school, you know, young teenager group of 90, and they would just hold on his every word. But he was always depressed and always down and always felt like a failure. I'd go and visit him. I'd go, Greg, your ministry's exploding. He'd go, yeah. And he'd talk about this going wrong and that going wrong. And so one time I was sitting with him. I said, Greg, you've got to see yourself differently. Like if you were looking at yourself through God's eyes, what would you say? And he said, almost, but not quite. What do you mean? Was my question almost good but not quite? He says, almost but not quite. That's what God would say. Like, good try, but you didn't make it. I said, Greg, that's not what God would say. I tried to argue, and then I said, did you ever hear that from your dad? And he said, all the time. It was never enough. He always pointed out what was wrong. I remember another friend of mine coming home from school with all ones, except for 1, 2. And some of you have different systems. Sometimes it's fives or whatever. Ones are the best in the Czech Republic. And his dad looked at it and he said, what happened here? Pointing to the two. You know, well, I have to be absolutely perfect to get my dad's pleasure. Pretty much what I can expect is disappointment. And that leaves some hard wounds. And it meant that Greg was evaluating himself through the same eyes. He was never satisfied. He was never pleased with himself because his dad wasn't pleased. And he projected that onto God and was sure that God was never pleased either. And God was always disappointed. Now, this can happen because of, so sometimes we get wounds in this area. So Greg didn't just have a vacuum. He had a wound. He wasn't just not getting pleasure. He was getting displeasure. He was getting beat up in that area of an area that he needed so much. And this is what happens when we have wounds. They create self-protection or distortion. They amplify things, or they cause us to behave in self-protective ways. So one of the reasons why Greg was so self-critical was if he could be self-critical, he could get ahead of your criticism. Say, I'm going to beat myself up so you don't have to. And it was a form of self-protection. Self-criticism was self-protection. I'll just be disappointed in myself before you are, and then I feel a little bit better. I'm safe. Or you could tell him 15 good things, and all the volume on those would be turned down, and one bit of criticism and the volume would be turned way up. It's like the message got distorted. It was coming in because it was going through a father filter and getting either turned up or turned down. Things were distorted. So wounds, particularly unhealed wounds, distort, and they cause self-protection. I had a mole removed from my chest a long time ago, and it didn't heal properly. And it hurt for probably 2 years. Have you ever had a wound that doesn't heal? It's a terrible thing, you know, like a sliver in you or something. It just hurt all the time. And because of that, I learned how to wear my seatbelt under my arm, because if I wore it in the right place, I would hurt the entire time I was driving. I also learned to hug people sideways, because if I hugged them straight, it hurt. And so do you see how it's distorting my behavior? And if you were watching me, you probably wouldn't understand that. You would go, Dave, don't you know enough to put, come on, the seatbelt goes above your arm, not below your arm. And you would see behavior that you couldn't understand, like, that's strange behavior. What's behavior to keep you from touching that wound? Because that wound, because this is what would happen, is if you came up to me and said, how you doing, Dave? And went like this, I would go, ah! Something that you meant innocently and was maybe an indication of affection, I would experience as a painful experience. Because what you were touching old pain and an old wound, and you were activating it. And because of that, I was self-protecting. It was distorting my behavior. You might say, that guy's strange. He, you know, after I learned how to hug, which was later on, but he only hugs from the side. Well, that's because hugging straight hurt. And a lot of strange behavior that we watch around us, we go, why are they doing that? Why are they responding that way? Actually goes back to unhealed wounds that people are either protecting or they're getting distorted. Why, when I just say a little word of criticism, does it just send you to the top? So father wounds or in this area are very significant. By the way, here's the crazy thing. You know, I want to be the best father possible, and I wound my kids too. You know, that's the crazy thing about it. Sometimes without knowing about it, I remember one time my son, we have something in Czech called tanečni, which you know, which the kids, when they're about 16 or 17, they all learn to dance. And there's all these ballroom dances that they do. And then at the very end of it, and they're special things, at the very end of it, everyone dresses up and they have a ball and all the parents come. And his ball came, and right before his ball, I got a call from someone I was counseling and was trying to save their marriage, and they said, we're going to get a divorce. And this was just really heavy on my mind. So I went, and I sat at the ball, and I was thinking about that broken-up marriage the whole time, how we're going to fix it, what I was going to do. And so you know how when you're thinking about something, you kind of stare off in the distance like this, looking at nothing, And you know, like I was preoccupied the whole tanečni with a problem that I couldn't solve. Well, we got home that evening, and evening went on. My wife said, "Dave, you got to go up to Caleb's room." I said, "Why?" He said, he's really mad at you right now. What? What did I do? What did I do? So I went up and he was laying on his bed over. I can't remember. I said, what's wrong? Caleb, he says, where were you tonight? Well, I was here trying to touch you. No, you were there, but you weren't there. Well, Caleb, you know, there's this problem that I'm dealing with. And he says, well, I'm your son. What problem that you're dealing with? And then he said this. He was mad. He said, Dad, the main reason I did Taneshni was to make you proud. And I kept looking at you, and you were just looking off into space. Oh, I felt terrible. I felt horrible. You know, and sometimes we don't realize that our kids' eyes are on us, and our eyes back on them, full of delight, is so important to them. It gives them. He went to 6 weeks of Taneshni to make his dad proud. And I was preoccupied and wasn't tuned in with him. So anyways, this is one of the problems. The dangers of parenting is we're going to do. And I even study this stuff and I still fail my kids in this area. And by the way, this is why we need a perfect father, right? So hopefully what we're going to cover these 2 days for you fathers will make you a better father, but you'll never be good enough to meet your kids' father needs. You really need to also be pointing them on to the true and perfect father. So self-protection wounds, and here's this last area, it's place. Let's go back into the story. 5:21, so we'll go back a little bit earlier. And he says, as a father raises the dead and gives him life, so also the son gives life to whom he will. For the father judges no one, but has given all judgment to the son, that all may honor the son as they honor the father. So look at this place. He says the father has life, and he's given life to his son. So the father has something that he actually shares with his son. So just think of, you know, a farmer on a tractor, and he says, son, come up here, or daughter, come up here, and sit beside me, and look, I'm making space in my world for you. There's a place where I am that I share with you. The father gives life, but he lets the son give life too. And then it says the father judges no one, but has entrusted all judgment to the son. So there the father actually entrusts something and walks away and says, it's yours now. You're going to do all the judging. And I'm not. And there's something about place that gives, and he says that all may honor the Son as they honor the Father. Place gives honor, which is why people want, you know, they want the name tag on their door. They want the spot because it gives honor, and we all want that. You saw that my dad's a farmer, and we lived in the city, but he thought we needed to learn how to farm, so. All the vacant lots around us, he would go to them and say, I'll keep your weeds down if you'll let me garden your lot. And so when I was about 8 or 9 years old, we lived on a lot in the city and the entire lot next door. So it was a large lot. So it probably would have been, you know, 1,200 square meters or something like that, 1,500 square meters. We turned into a garden for free because we kept the weeds down. And one of the things my dad did that first year is he took some string and he made 4 spots, and he says, Joyce, this is yours. Dave, this is yours. Steve, this is yours. Josh, this is yours. And we all got a piece of the garden. And then he said, what do you want to plant in your garden? So we looked through the seeds, and my sister wanted tomatoes. My brother wanted cucumbers. I looked to the very end of the seeds, and I said, I want to plant popcorn. And you know, you can actually grow popcorn, so it's possible to grow. So all right, I got my popcorn. So my dad said, hey, let's go out and let me help you plant your popcorn. Now, he'd purchased the seeds. He prepared the ground. But we were working and planting my popcorn. And then, hey, Dave, let's go weed your popcorn. And here's how you care for your popcorn. And there was something about being entrusted with a piece of the garden that was, I just felt, you know, like I was somebody, like I got a piece of this. It's not just a big garden. I'm just helping Dad everywhere, but he's actually entrusted a part of it to me. Now, one of the frustrating things was that that tomatoes were harvested quickly, cucumbers were harvested after that. You have to wait a long time for popcorn. And then when you pick it, you have to let it dry for probably 2 months till it's just the right consistency to where it'll pop. And it wasn't until almost Christmas that we had popcorn. But then we had so much popcorn. We had just barrels of popcorn. And whenever anyone would come visit us, my parents would say, "Hey, you want some of Dave's popcorn?" I'd go, "Yeah, you want some of my popcorn? You know, that's Dave's popcorn. He grew it." "Yeah, Dave grew it." You know, there's something about pride in a place that belongs to you and a place that is yours. And we all need that. By the way, we're going to find out tomorrow how God gives you a place in his kingdom. I mean, you've got a place in his mansion. He's going to go to prepare a place for you. There's something about a place. We actually need, you need a place. You need one. And it gives so much honor. I remember also my dad would entrust us with different responsibilities. We'd go on vacation and he'd say, "Dave, you're in charge of packing." And so everyone would come out with their various things that they want in the car and they'd say, "Where should this go?" And my dad would say, "I don't know, ask Dave. He's in charge of packing." "Yes, I'm in charge of packing. Do you see how that place? I have a place in this family. I've been entrusted with something on behalf of the whole family." And I'd get that in and I'd say, "Well, isn't that good, you know?" My mom would say, "I can't believe you got it all in." "Yeah, that's amazing, isn't it? Wow, you know. Do you see honor? Like, I can't, you did that. That's yours. I'm doing it on behalf of the whole family." I remember this continued when I was even older. I started running a youth ministry in Germany on military bases, and my dad said, "You need to meet the chief of chaplains for the entire military." "Oh, really? Where is he? "Well, he's in Washington, D.C. "Oh, we're in Washington, D.C. In the Pentagon. You know, the Pentagon, the largest building in the world where the American military has its headquarters. He says, "I want to take you there and introduce you to him, because he needs to know about your work." So I remember flying to Washington, D.C. with my dad and going into the Pentagon, this huge building. It's a crazy building. To this office where General, I don't know what his name was, but he had a star on his shoulder, the top chaplain for the entire United States military. And we went in the office and my dad said, "My son's doing some great work with young people. I want you to meet him. Dave, tell him about your work." Do you see that place? Like I'm defining and defending place. We're going to get to the fact that God does this with you. It's just amazing how he makes a place for you in his plan and in his family. But a lot of people don't get this, right? Some actually, fathers compete with their children for who's the best. They do. They actually compete with them, or feel like, "Hey, everything that's mine is mine. You've got to find your own way." And they don't entrust, or else if they entrust something, it's always as an assistant. It's not actually something that's given to their children, and the children grow up without any sense of place. And maybe even you today feel sometimes like you're a squatter in the place that you have, and you don't really, you're fighting for your place. And what will happen? Do you have purpose? What will happen? Well, if there's vacuums, you'll be dead. "I don't care about my place." Or you'll be pulling, trying to find it. If there's wounds, you will be self-protective. You'll be fighting for your place. Or you'll be distorted. Somebody will just say one thing and you'll lose your place because it's amplified or turned down. So this place has really honor, and it's going to impact all of those different things. So now we've kind of built a basic picture, right? So four things that the Father gives. We desperately need him. We're impacted by our earthly fathers in ways that we don't realize. And actually, it filters what we experience from God, what we expect from him, what we experience from him, where if we turn to him. We're going to talk some about what we do about that tomorrow. And all of us have a combination of gifts, vacuums, and wounds. We just all have that. And it affects us in ways that we maybe don't realize.